Cloudcast Media.
Welcome to Your Next Mission Podcast with the 12th Sergeant Major of the Army and co-founder of the American Freedom Foundation, Jack L. Tilley. Proudly presented by Cavalry Agency, Navy Federal Credit Union, Purdue University Global, and Veterans United Home Loans.
Hello out there, veterans and families, and welcome to Your Next Mission, a new program initiative of the American Freedom Foundation. I'm Jack L. Tilley, 12th Sergeant Major of the Army, and your host. And today's episode is the first in a series that will air each day this week, commemorating the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the 9/11 in the Pentagon. This series will culminate with a live Your Next Mission podcast from the Air Force Memorial in Washington, D.C. on September 9/11th. Also, will share my personal story about 9/11, and just like all of you, it certainly affected me and for the rest of my life. And so, I want to make sure I share my story. Now, before we get started, I want to thank all our presenting sponsors: Cavalry Agency, Navy Federal Credit Union, Purdue University Global, and Veterans United Home Loans for making Your Next Mission happen. They love our veterans and families, and they believe in what we do each and every day. And we love them, certainly do. As I mentioned, today's episode is the first in a series that will commemorate the 20th anniversary of the attack on the Pentagon on 9/11 with the hope that we will never forget the events of that horrific day in our history. And I'm so excited to introduce Mr. Stephen Lofgren, Chief of Field Programs and Historical Services and Director at the U.S. Army Center for Military History. Welcome, Steve. So glad to have you on the podcast.
I'm really pleased to be here, and thank you for inviting me, Chet. Appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Yeah, well, we're just honored and to hear the stories that you have to tell. We want to make sure that that our audience understands that, historians, and I mean, they just tell the truth and tell exactly what happened on that day. And that's what we want to hear. We want to hear, what went on. 9/11 is an infamous day in the history of our country, and I know our audience is eager to, hear the account of that day. But before we get started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and, how you got into what you're doing today, I guess?
The quick answer is, when you study history as an undergraduate, people always ask you, well, history, what are you going to do with that? And I'm one of the few people who have found a living working for the U.S. Army Center of Military History after going to graduate school. And the center has a great mission to educate, inspire, and preserve the Army and the American people about the history of the U.S. Army, which is a fascinating and uplifting history that is central to so much of what has transpired in our nation from the founding to today. I run a division that does a lot of work for the headquarters department of the Army. That's sort of our specialty, and we do a lot of oral history, and we try to write an annual history of the Army from a HQDA perspective each year. And so we're very Pentagon focused, which is how we got involved in the coverage of 9/11. It's a great job for someone interested in history, interested in policy and institutions, and interested in the Army. So it's, I get paid to read Army history. That's great.
Well, it is good. The thing about it, and when you was talking, I was thinking about that, a lot of history, I've been told this, and I'm sure it's true, a lot of history, a lot of times it repeats itself. And that's really sort of a scary thought when we start talking about 9/11 and things that went on in that day. Let's set the stage for what happened on 9/11 at the Pentagon. Can you sort of set the stage for us a little bit about the attack on 9/11?
Yes, but I think it's important for listeners to understand the building, because the building is the terrain on which this all takes place. And the Pentagon is a huge concrete structure, right? It's built during World War II. It covers about 29 acres of land, the building itself. It's people who haven't seen it don't realize, you know, it's 60, 70 feet tall in the highest parts. The outside walls are, you know, more than 900 feet. It's got five rings, concentric rings, and the innermost, they're roughly 360 feet in length. You know, when you start corridors that run from the inside to the outside, you know, they're longer than a football field, about 400 feet long. So just talking an immense building that, you know, on 9/11 had around 20,000 people working in it. And so it's really a small city in one area. And one thing that had been going on with the Pentagon starting several years earlier was they finally were getting around to renovating the building from, you know, it being built in World War II. And, you know, a lot of changes from World War II. You know, we don't use asbestos anymore. And so they divided the Pentagon into wedges that were being renovated because it's impossible to do it all at one time. And so by September 11th, what they called Wedge One, the renovation had been completed, and which means they had moved everyone out. They had rebuilt everything inside. They replaced windows and wiring and with, you know, external protection and, you know, blast resistant windows. In light of the obvious rising terrorist threat across the world. And they were getting ready to work on Wedge Two, which, so just throw two numbers. There's like 17 and a half miles of corridor in the Pentagon, you know, and there's like a replacing a 100,000 miles of telephone wire. So it just gives it, I think people don't understand how, you've been in there a lot, so you understand how vast the building is.
Yeah.
And, but this is a, you know, in the five stories. And so this is the structure and the environment in which all these people are going about on their, doing their jobs on the morning of Tuesday, September 11th, you know, 9:37, when this Boeing 757 crashes into the building, having been hijacked in flight by five terrorists, killing 59 passengers, including the crew, and including, you know, a couple headed for a honeymoon in Hawaii, and family vacationing with small children. So it just would have been horrible if the plane had just crashed itself. But this is.
Stephen, if it really seemed like it hit in the best place ever, because that was a place that had been renovated. If I think I heard you right, it had been renovated. So it probably hit in the base, in the best place. And I think once it hit, it didn't directly hit. It sort of skipped the ground before it hit first, didn't it? Or did it?
Yes, it kind of, one wing clipped. So it was an angle and bounced a little, I believe, going in. It's, you know, we're, this is based on eyewitness accounts, and there's limited visual imagery just because of the, you know, digital photographs and the surveillance cameras aren't, you know, what we expect today, but many people saw it hit and bounce in. And you're right. It hit Which I tell people, if it hit the other side of the building, it could have taken out the, you know, National Military Command Center with the Secretary of Defense, who was visiting there at the time, and his entire office. And you could have had many more people killed. So it hit a reinforced area. And, you know, these, the blast resistant windows, you know, worked in most cases. You know, there's like little holes, but they did not break and did not create storms of shards of glass flying into windows at people around the E ring, which is the, you know, most external ring, as you know. And so it hit and then continued into the building, into an unrenovated area. And that's where a lot of the casualties happen, because the building absorbs the blow of the plane for the most part and kind of channels the kinetic impact.
There's a center of the Pentagon in there too. It almost went to the center, didn't it? It went through like three or four different rings.
It went through three and went into what they call A&E Drive, which is the, you know, in between the B and C rings. And it actually punctured through the wall there. It's about 12, 15 foot wide hole, and with bits of the plane, you know, went through, and the overpressure. And so A&E Drive is a ring within the Pentagon that you can, you know, look all the way up and there's nothing there, and from the ground, and vehicles drive around in there, and the air pressure came up and blew windows in. We're talking to one colonel who returned to his office, you know, a month later and found the sofa in his office, where the metal blinds had been drawn up that morning, just punctured with glass, you know, so anyone sitting there would have been, you know, hit with it.
I know when I was in the Pentagon, and in fact, I just walked out of the Pentagon when it hit, and I came back in and ran back in the Pentagon. And I remember going back in, running back into the Pentagon, and then I checked on my office, and then I ran back around and went to where actually the plane had hit, and myself and General Van Alstyne, I think it was, tried to work our way into the Pentagon to see if we could help anybody or pull anybody out. But one of the things that I've been heard, and I'd be interested to see what you think about that, is that the Pentagon in some ways trapped people too, because of the firewalls in the Pentagon. They went down and people were you know, trapped in an office or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I have trouble understanding the role of the firewalls, because okay. I know they were closing in some areas, but I also, so in Wedge One in particular, all these people were moving back into new offices in spaces they were unfamiliar with often. And it was where I first heard the term cubicle farm, you know, in these big areas where, yeah, you know, there's, you know, maybe 80 people have cubicles. And so even if the impact of the, so there's two things, there's a violent shaking when this goes on. And I think for a lot of us, it's really difficult to understand how you just went from your normal work day, and then all these people are thrust into what's literally a nightmare environment, as this, you know, darkness and destruction just sweeps through the building and everything goes black. Ceilings are falling down, false ceilings fall, lights are falling, furniture's tipping over, internal walls are tipping over. So suddenly the new environment where people were working has just been radically altered. And there's, you know, you can't see because the power has gone out in that area. for many people, there's the huge deafening noise. And then there's all these, you know, tens of thousands of gallons of jet fuel.
I'm just going to ask about, yeah.
Pushed in and explode and start burning from the plane. And so on top of the sudden shock, and, you know, a lot of people weren't aware of what had happened in the previous half hour up in New York. So they're totally taken by surprise. And for this happens, and then, you know, work areas start filling up with fire and this thick black smoke that, you know, literally kills people in places. And many people are very disoriented around the crash site and I think that's just, you know.
Well, I'd heard stories. I'm sure you've heard a lot of stories, but I've heard a couple of stories about people. And when you talked about the security of the windows, where they tried to break windows, they couldn't break the windows because of the Mylar, I guess it was, or the security windows on there. The other thing I heard is stories about people that were, because of the smoke and the fire and everything, was crawling, and maybe two or three of them go left, two or three go right, and the ones that went left died, and the ones that went right lived. Because just what you just said, they was disoriented, didn't know exactly what was going on. The attack on the Pentagon changed our lives. There's no question about it. And can you describe the impact and how the people were subtly thrust into a nightmare, which had, you know, they struggled to really just survive? Can you, did you talk to a lot of people about that? I mean, the ones that got out I'm sure a lot of them didn't want to go back into the Pentagon, but there's probably a lot of stories that you can probably just share with us.
One of the, this is more of a concluding comment. What really struck me in doing interviews with people who'd been in the building and responded was just their resilience. And, you know, some people, okay, I'm done, you know, that was their feeling, but it was really a minority. And, for so many people, I'm not going to let someone drive me away from my workplace or stop my way of life. But so that's just a quick comment.
No, I think you're right. I think people were just. I know me personally now. I was just angry. I was angry about what happened, and I'd be damned if anybody was going to push me out, because, you know, I'm an American, I love this country, and you're not going to push me out. The other thing I think it did too was it, for a fraction of a second in this country, it pulled us all together. It really got us a lot closer, and I think everybody in the Pentagon that did have, whatever your wound was, whatever your issue was, whatever it was, for that particular second, everybody really very quickly came together, and there was really more, not just the Pentagon, not just the people in the Pentagon. I remember seeing people outside the Pentagon, the fire department, the ambulances, all the people that came out. There certainly was scared, but they all pulled together and say, "Hey, we're going to figure this out. We're going to help the people we can in the Pentagon and do what's right." So I'm sure that a lot of people you talked to. I didn't want to talk a lot, but this is such an incredible event that affected so many people's lives that we just can't allow ourselves to forget. And like I said to you before, it's not when, because I think it'll happen again in our country. I just don't know when, but it's sort of a scary thought. Your thoughts about that?
This was Pearl Harbor for a couple of generations, you know, and in terms of, you know, Pearl Harbor being the, you know, the Japanese attack on the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor on, you know, December 7th, 1941, which is what propels the U.S. into World War II, and thereby really changes America, the course of American history. And, you know, the terrorist attack of 9/11 have, you know, fundamentally changed the course of American history, and now we have just set us off in a somewhat different direction, and we see the consequences, you know, daily, and historians will look back in 50 and 100 years and point to it, just like the firing of cannons against Fort Sumter, you know, in the spring of 1861 when the southern states seceded from the Union.
Yeah.
And it's And so from a macro historical view, yes, this is, it was huge and it's difficult. You know, I'm struck by, you know, 20 years ago. So that means, you know, virtually every freshman in college this fall will have been born after 9/11.
And they don't know anything about it.
Yeah. And won't have the experience of, you know, just being stunned or watching it on TV and watching, you know, planes fly into World Trade Centers in New York. And
I think of 9/11. I think what they ought to do is make sure they show those pictures again every year. I think they ought to show the pictures of the Pentagon being hit. I think they ought to show New York and Pennsylvania and all that stuff. And I think you ought to talk about it. In fact, for the listeners out there that are listening today, I think you need to remember something. And I'm going to make sure I get my numbers right. But you're 64 in a plane and 125 people at 9/37 on 9/11 died just within a matter of minutes. And it just wasn't that day. It affected our entire country. And it still affects a lot of people that certainly don't know anything about. And we always talk about the people that were hurt, but the ones that survived, I guess, the military spouses and the people that were wounded and all of that other stuff. I mean, that's something we don't talk a lot about because people I hate to even say that. We forget so quick about those people got injured. Did you ever go talk to anybody in the hospital or anything about 9/11 or interviewed any of those guys?
We interviewed a few people who were hospitalized, in the first few days, but we tried to wait for the most part until they were out. And there's, I understand the immediacy of some interviews. I also have I'm probably not the best interviewer in that I shy away from getting too much into someone's personal space. So we did interview a couple of injured people, but we also talked to many people who had been injured later. I was thinking about some snippets of stories of specific people that I could relate just to.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, no, that's
give a
fine.
Range
yeah,
of yeah. So one, and these are actually, I'm going to reorder my program a little bit here and say, you know, so one of the impressive General John Keane, who was the vice chief of staff at the time.
I know him.
the next day, he called. Brigadier General John Sloan Brown, who is the chief of military history, and said, you need to cover this. We need to document this so we don't forget what happened and so that we can understand it in the future and tell me what you need. And then he promptly sent an email out virtually to the world telling them that he wanted us to do interviews and asking, you know, for support from the Army and directing support, and which is, you know, his historical mindedness I can only applaud, as it's not always shared. But and that set us up at the Center of Military History to conduct, you know, we roughly had 14 people at the center, or military history detachments. These are three-person units with an officer and two NCOs who conduct history operations and do interviews. And we together did close to 1,000 interviews, and there were other Army history offices, because, you know, for historians, we recognize how significant this event was and would be in the future. And, you know, it'd be if you could go back and if you'd been present in December 7th, 1941 as a history office, you would have wanted to interview everyone there to capture it for the record.
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget about the important, and my hat's off to General Keane about jumping out real quick and say, hey, you know, we need to document this. And you need to document it when it's fresh in your mind. Because, you know, everything changes one day, 2 days, 3 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, 5 years. It all changes how, you know, what happened on that day. So, you know, it's important. We're talking with Stephen Lofgren from the U.S. Army Center of Military History about 9/11 attack on the Pentagon. And you're listening to Your Next Mission podcast with me, your host, Jack L. Tilley, 12th Sergeant Major Army. And Steve, I'm sure you've heard of the documented some of the individuals who were directly affected by events, which we was already talking about. Can you give me some more stories, I guess, about those? Some of the most interesting stories that you had.
So working from the outside of the building in, Captain Lincoln Liebner, who was Special Forces and was actually an aide for Secretary Rumsfeld, was at home in D.C. watching TV and saw the news about New York and said, okay, I'm getting dressed, getting into the, it was his off day, he's going in the Pentagon. And he gets there in time to see the plane hit the building. Mm. And self-critique, he always said he could see into the plane, and I was daunted from asking him what he could see, because he got very quiet when we interviewed in the one of the big cafeterias in the Pentagon, and it was
I think sometimes people imagine things too. I mean I would never question whether or not he could or couldn't see into the plane, but a plane going at that speed, coming off that way it did, that's a little hard.
And and then he went and this is sort of the story of the day, of people helping other people or trying to help other people. He immediately went over to the crash site and tried going into the building and did assist a couple women coming to get out of the building until they later took him to the hospital and treat him for smoke inhalation. Wow. Which is, I mean, I'm the long-term health consequences for a number of the people in the building that day was particularly the non-fire department responders who were, you know, going in and sucking in that all the dust and the fuel. That's sort of a long-term concern I have. And then came back and essentially had to be ordered to go home by Admiral, I always forget his name, Jim Batista, who was a military assistant for Secretary Rumsfeld. Year later was being pilloried in the French press for lying about it was, you know, not a plane, it was a missile.
And, I had somebody that asked me the same thing. He said, I can't remember where I was at. They said, was there really a plane that hit the Pentagon? I said, well, I'll just tell you something. I picked up pieces of the plane. And you know, there was people out there walking around. So you can think what you want to think. I seen it personally. I seen what happened. And again, I want our listeners to realize that it was a terrible, terrible day for our country. At 9:37, it hit the Pentagon and killed, like I said, 125 people in the Pentagon and killed, you know, husbands, fathers, senior leaders. I think the senior person that was killed was Lieutenant General Maud that was killed in the Pentagon. And you hear also, I got to tell you a little story for myself. I had one friend that told me that one of the guys he knew had to go to the bathroom. And so because he had a go to the latrine, I guess, or the restroom, or whatever you want to call it, it saved his life. He wasn't in the conference room that was hit, and that's the only thing that saved his life. We'll be right back. You're listening to Your Next Mission podcast. Thank you.
This Your Next Mission podcast is made possible by the Cavalry Agency. They help brands dominate no matter their size. Ideas, strategy, action. This is Cavalry. Learn more at cavalry.com. Navy Federal Credit Union, the most trusted credit union owned by members of the military community, serving all branches of the armed forces and their families. Their members are the mission. Learn more at NavyFederal.org. Purdue Global, providing affordable online education for hardworking adults. Learn more about a personalized, innovative, and world-class education at purdueglobal.edu. Veterans United Home Loans, the number one VA lender for 5 straight years. If you're buying, they're funding your dreams. Learn more at veteransunited.com.
Welcome back. I'm the 12th Sergeant Major of the Army, Jack L. Tilley, and we're blessed to be here today with Stephen Lofgren from the Army Center of Military History. And I want all of our listeners to reach out to me directly. Tell us the topics you'd like us to cover on the podcast. I mean, this podcast is not ours. It's just like we're talking about 9/11. We want to talk about things that we want you to know. And of course, we want to talk about things I want you to know too. But I think there's a lot of interesting things in the country that we need to share with each other because we're all part of a family. You can call or text me at 844-424-1134 and I'll reach out to you. You know, I'll either call you or text you back, or you can send me an email at smatilly @yournextmission.org. Okay, let's pick it up where we left off. You're listening to Your Next Mission podcast with I'm Jack Tilley, 12th Sergeant Major of the Army. We're talking with Mr. Stephen Lofgren, Chief of Field Programs, Historical Services Director at the U.S. Army Center of Military History. And we're heading into our final segment with you today. And the knowledge you've had of 9/11 is really amazing. I mean, I wish I could sit here for 3 or 4 hours and sort of pick your brain about some of this stuff. And I really just have a couple more questions. Steve, can you tell me a little bit about the Army historical coverage of 9/11? I mean, you already talked about it. I mean, you talked about the fact that General Keane says, hey, you know, very quickly come out and start documenting all this stuff. But is there anything else there that you'd like to share with us about your organization, about what you guys do, about 9/11 and all the stuff that you certainly documented?
So the organization is it's an amazing place, and I think unique in how we document the history of the Army, write about contemporary operations, write about historical operations. You know, and you have full-time historians dedicated to that. There's historians who are dedicated to tracking the unit lineages of every unit in the U.S. Army, and they maintain those. And we also have the incredible Army Museum enterprise as part of the center, including the recently opened National Museum of the United States Army. So it's really, the Center of Military History is a national treasure that educates and, you know, it preserves our historical memory and I think educates people and the soldiers and inspires everyone who attends and goes to a museum. So for what we did was we spent months reaching out to people, piling lists of people who were present, were willing, you know, asking if they were willing to be interviewed. And this is voluntary, right? No one sits, you know, the Army doesn't force people to sit for interviews. So it's, you know, people who are willing to do so.
They should force them. I think it's so important that I mean, force is probably the wrong word, but they should encourage people
they,
to sit
and they
out.
Do encourage. Yeah. They do encourage. It's like, you know, some people just aren't comfortable speaking on the record or being recorded. And I understand that. And particularly, you know, I would say even more today than 20 years ago.
I think so.
And as you know, from personal experience, it's very easy to have a snippet taken out of
context. Yeah.
Context. Yeah. And, but, you know, we did, we did a lot of interviews. Like I said, we did ourselves, we did close to 1,000. And, you know, some of them, you know, for some people, it was like a therapy session. Like you actually get a chance to tell your story and have someone sit and listen to it and record it. That can be very validating, as well as historically informative and important.
What if somebody wanted to go back, you know, like I said, I was in 9/11. What if I wanted to go back and contact you guys and want to read some of those documents? Am I free to do that? Or you guys make access to that information? So if I want to do some research on 9/11, can I go into the Army historical stuff and sort of look and peek and read?
I'm going to give a qualified yes. You know, where it hasn't been. So I'll say a qualified yes. Some interviews haven't been transcribed. You know, they're when we start having 1,000 and you start handing people, well, here's the bill to transcribe and edit all these, and that gets
quite expensive.
Yeah, and there's priorities, right?
So, I would think that most of the 9/11 things have been transcribed by now. I mean, you probably got all that stuff out. I'm really sort of talking about 9/11. Yeah,
and people have used them, and yes, the general sense they're available, and our archivists will be very pleased to hear me drumming up work for them and say that's insane.
Yeah. Let me, if you're going back to 9/11 and you're thinking about what would be the three things that you'd want to tell our audience about 9/11, the three things that you think you want to, I can think of a couple of things, you know, what time did it hit? 9/37, how many people were killed? Something that, that the audience needs to know, I think, from this discussion, I guess.
Well, I would say it's a high point for the Army as an institution and a collection of people, and for how this collection of people performed under incredible stress and in danger, and then over the next significant period of time. And so we talk about in the moment, people are in rooms that have suddenly filled with black smoke down to their knees. And there's, I think of Martha Carden, who is in, worked for General Maud, who you mentioned, and is the executive assistant. She's in another meeting with about 8 or 9 people, and you know, the fireball blasts through their conference room, and you know, this Colonel Rob Grunwald, you know, jumps across the table and grabs her, and it's like, okay, I'm getting you out of here. And she holds onto his belt, and they get together, and they essentially crawl out of the room. And as she says, you know, he saved my life. He literally saved my life by getting me out of there. And she says she was crawling. She was waiting for her clothes to catch on fire because it was that hot. So there's the coming together and support, and this helping other people was everywhere in the building, and as well as, you know, the horror of what happened to people. I think Dave King, who was a major in the Deputy Chief of Staff Operation for Programs, you know, which is now the G8, and he got burned pretty badly, you know. And he says he's looking down, he's trying to, they said crawl on the floor, and he looks down, and he's like, well, you know, that's what they tell you when you're in smoke, right? Get down low. And he's like, okay, but the carpeting on the floor is on fire. Wow. You know, and he's trying to beat out, you know, his, you know, smoking pants. And when he emerges into another office, you know, one of the colonels in there later said, you look like a ghost because you were white from, and you had your arms out with like white skin hanging from them. And he later made a successful recovery from, you know, third degree burns and parts. And there's, you know, so there's stories like there's General John Wood, who's a, you know, major general and the head of the strategy and plans division in what's now G3, and plane hits. And he's like, okay, let's get out of my office. And his door is like jammed shut. And then Brigadier General Carl Eikenberry ultimately like, kicks the door down from the outside when he realizes he's locked in there, and helps him get out. And General Eikenberry, you know, he's later ambassador to Afghanistan, and he's a big guy.
Yeah.
So someone in the Pentagon, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but where the plane hit, about a half hour after that, it had taken out the point in which the plane entered the building and took out all these supporting structures, created a lot of stress on the floors above it. And so about 35 minutes after the plane had hit, all those floors collapsed.
Yeah.
And when you look at the pictures that were taken of the collapsed building, you're looking into General Wood's office. Yeah. So it was, timely that he was able to get out.
I remember standing outside the Pentagon when it was all burning and stuff. And I remember turning and looking. And when I turned back, that floor collapsed. Just as I was looking right there. So I remember that distinctly. Go ahead, Steve.
So I just, the desire to help, even if it put the helper in danger, was just a uniform sentiment, it seemed like, across the Pentagon population. And, just impressive. The renovation of the building saved lives. I think that's important to note. Chance, random chance, where you stand. You mentioned someone going to the bathroom. That there's several, woman Brenda Hershey, or no, Ann Parnum, was Army librarian, happened to go to a photocopier to make a copy that put her behind a pillar just as this fireball came through. And so just the randomness with which one's life could be altered.
Yeah.
I also mentioned it being a high point for the Army. I love the story of people sneaking, the IT folks spending the first few days in the building, sneaking into areas that were now, supposedly off limits because it was a crime scene, to remove servers, to get plugged up somewhere else because they knew they were central to the Army continuing to function.
Yeah.
And it's, September 11th, that's less than 3 weeks from the end of the fiscal year. And the RSW, the resources office that handles all the budgeting for HQDA, they lost like 3/4 of their people were killed because they were right in the impact area.
I think the operations cell of the Navy also, the majority of them was killed too. Yeah.
And so you had all these retirees for the Army come back to work, and say they'll come in to help close out if you haven't worked the Army budget, you don't realize what a mammoth job that is to get, the September is like a hellish month for those people because they work, day round. And the Army also that morning, starting up at Walter Reed, they set up a program called Operation Solace, which was to offer counseling for anyone who needed. And they really made an effort because, even today, and it was much more 20 years ago, there's a stigma or was a stigma of seeking out some mental health provider to talk to someone. And God knows officers wouldn't want to be seen doing that.
Yeah.
And these people literally contacted everyone in the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And made things very confidential so you could go in and talk and just, and I think that was an important step for people recognizing, hey, sometimes you do need to talk to someone, but it was important for the, I think, showing hey, the Army is showing that it cares for its people, which is important to do, but actually doing it too and making this available.
Yeah, I would tell you, Stephen, at that time, because I was a Sergeant Major of the Army at that time, I remember quite a few people coming to me and sitting down and talking to him. So, I understand. I think a lot of people in the Pentagon at that time did as much as they could about counseling and hugging people and patting them on the back and say, you know, everything's going to be okay. The other thing is always interesting to me that, sometimes people run away from incidents like this. Majority of people that were service members ran to it wherever it was happening. And they didn't shy away from what was going on. If there was something bad there, they tried to fix it. If you was hurt, they'd try to help you. But they was scared, but they was focused. Again, it's always like running to the sound of the guns. That's exactly what you do, you know.
Absolutely. And when you talk to the fire department chief, who was the incident commander, particularly that first day, one of the great challenges was keeping all the military under control and out of the way from the, because they're so wanting to get in there and help.
Well, but the thing about that is, and I was standing right there when the fire trucks and everybody coming and showed up and like that. And I thought they pulled together very quickly. But it's like anything else. It was a fire. They wanted to take charge of the fire, and the military wanted to take charge of people. So I think, within a matter of minutes, they all worked it all out and tried to get.
I don't mean that.
No, I know you don't.
But in a negative way. It's just it's a concern. You've got, hundreds of people who are like, all right, we're ready to go in. You give us the word and we're going in. They're like, let us fight the fire first, because as the fire persisted, for a couple of days up in the roof area.
Stephen, I'm going to tell you, we're probably going to cut off here in a minute, but I'm going to tell you one more thing. I was there and I remember the old guard coming out after they put the fire out and they did all this stuff, they wanted the old guard to go in and then people that are listening, you got to understand there's, 125 people killed in the Pentagon, but they wanted the, old guard, which is a ceremonial unit up in Washington, D.C., to go in and pick up the remains. And I said, no, they're not going to do that. What they'll do is you have mortuary affairs go in and pick up the remains and put them in the body bags and then bring them out. The other thing I think people need to realize that, a lot of things, it was just pieces of people because of what the fire did and everything else it did there. And it's important for us not to forget the sacrifices that our military makes for our country and the kind of things like you and General Keane and all the rest of them did on that particular day about remembering about history. Because, again, I said it before and I'll say it again, it's not if, it's when things like that happen again. And so for that, Stephen, I just want to thank you for talking about it today. I know it's probably tough for you to talk about, and there's a lot of people, even today, that struggle through finding the right words to sort of address what those issues are and what happened on that particular day. But my golly, I appreciate it so much, you coming on the podcast and giving people an idea about the day. And also tell you the people that are listening out there, go back and look at a history a little bit and read about the things that happened that day and read about the people that each and every day fight for your rights to be free. And a lot of times we want to, ignore history. Don't ignore history. Never ignore history. Remember the kind of things that went on. Never forget. And I'm Jack Tilley, 12th Sergeant Major of the Army. You're listening to Your Next Mission podcast. And thank you for listening today. If I can help you in any way, please reach out to me. You can, send something to our website at yournextmission.org, and we'll certainly answer you. Or please know that I want to assist you in any way that I can. I want to help you in anything that I can. Just like Stephen, we don't know each other personally, but I know just listening to Steve that he's there, I'm there. We're all Americans and we'll help each other out. So don't be afraid to ask for help. Please follow us on my personal social media channels at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn. And thanks again, Stephen. From the U.S. Army Center of Military History for being with us today. It was great having you on the podcast. And I hope people, I pray that people listen to what you said. There's a lot of things that we talked about, a lot of things that people forget about. But the fact of the matter is on that day, 125 people at 9:37 died in probably a matter of seconds when that plane hit the Pentagon. And the jet fuel, it wasn't, you know, war's not pretty, and what happened that day is not pretty. So don't forget, we want to hear from you. Please leave me a message or send me a text at 844-424-1134. Send me an email at smatilly@yournextmission.org. I really want to hear from you. And again, Stephen, God bless you, and thank you for being on the podcast. I want to end each podcast with a little story about me and the experiences of my Army and my life. And really today I wanted to share with you what I was doing on 9/11. And on 9/11, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to make it a little bit shorter. But I was in the Pentagon. I was sitting at my desk, and I was getting ready to go somewhere. And a friend of mine, David Shad, called me on the phone. He said, "Sergeant Major, you gotta turn on the TV real quick and see what happened in New York." And I turned it on, and I watched the second plane hit in amazement. I couldn't believe it. And I was just getting ready to walk out, and I told the people in the office that don't think that can't happen to us. Now, that was about 8:45 or something like that, or 8:30 when I was leaving. I said, "I want you to stay close to the phones and make sure you keep me updated what's going on, because I know something's happening. This is not normal." So I got in a vehicle and I drove over to Fort Myer, and I talked to a group of people. And I was coming down the hill by Fort Myer when the plane hit. And I remember seeing that explosion when it hit. And just like I told Stephen a little while ago, I wasn't going to turn and go the other direction. I turned my vehicle, or we made sure we got on the highway, got back into the Pentagon. And I remember going by a security guard, because they're doing their jobs. And he said, "Stop, you can't go back into the Pentagon. We've had, whatever." And I just sort of jumped over whatever the obstacle was in front of me and just kept moving, just ignored him, and went back to the office that I was working in. And I checked first to make sure all the people in the office was out. And of course, the door was locked and they was gone, and I was happy about that. And then I went around to the front where the plane hit. And I would tell you that there was a plane. There's no question about that. The plane did hit, and it killed 125 people in the Pentagon. And so I did what every other soldier would do. I did all I could to try to save the lives of the people I knew that were in that building. And so I tried to work my way back into the building myself and General Van Alstyne. And after we went probably 30, 40 feet back into the there was a little like a corridor off to the left side where the plane hit. And I said, "I'm going to do all I can to help people." And I couldn't go but probably 30 or 40 feet. And then the smoke was so bad. And I told the general, I said, "Look, we can go farther, but we'll be a casualty. It's best for us to back out of here and get the right equipment or let the right people come in there." So we backed out. And I think the hardest thing for me to do after that was to stand there and watch watch what people were doing as far as shoring up, putting out the fire, and doing all those other things, and then watch the people that were pulling together in this great country. I said before, there was ambulances or FBI, there was police, there was, you name it, fire trucks, all pulling together and trying to do all they could to save lives within the Pentagon. And it's tough. It's tough when you know that you just can't do anything. And so, again, I just stood there and I tried to help. I did the best I could. And there's not much you can do. I tell people all the time, I've seen so much death in my life, and I've seen so many things that occurred that I wish I could blot them out of my brain, but I can't. They're still there. And in fact, I remember stepping over bodies and doing things years ago, but not in this country. Not into this country do we want to see something like 9/11 happen. Not in this country do we want to see Americans die. And this is not a battlefield. You can understand that, or I don't know if you can understand it. On the battlefield, there's people that'll die, but not in this country. I don't want to never see anything like that ever again happen. And so I just simply tell you that on 9/11, just don't forget. Don't forget about the kind of sacrifices that our country makes, that our military makes each and every day, and that Stephen makes for making sure all that stuff is documented about what happened, so we don't we don't forget. I think it's so important. Probably not a day goes by that I don't remember some of my friends that died on that day. So I hope you listen this week. I hope you listen to things that we're going to talk about. And if you have questions, I gave you a phone number so you can call us and ask. So tomorrow is Thursday, September 9th. We'll air a second of these series on our Your Next Mission podcast, commemorating the 20th anniversary on the attack of the Pentagon on 9/11. Please be sure to tune in and hear Miss Terry Maude give her account of that tragic day that took the life of her husband, Lieutenant General Timothy Maude. And just real quickly, if you can imagine that your loved one that you kissed goodbye that day that left and never came home again. And, you know, it's about life. It's about God. It's about believing each and every day in your fellow man and woman that, you know, that we need to never, never forget. So listen to Miss Maude. I know it's going to be tough for her to get through that, but she's going to tell the story about how her life was changed just in a matter of seconds. Again, thanks for listening. Thanks to Cloudcast Media and, of course, our four presenting sponsors, Calvary Agency, Navy Federal Credit Union, Purdue University Global, and Veterans United Home Loans. We appreciate all you do for our military, and please listen tomorrow and the rest of the week as we pay tribute to all of those that was affected by 9/11. God bless each and every one of you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Your Next Mission, brought to you by the American Freedom Foundation. Learn more by visiting yournextmission.org.
Cloudcast Media.